Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. We've been promising this for a couple of weeks now. You all loved Sharp's reunion so much. But in truth, it was frantic getting it together and getting the lovely Sean Bean on. And so we weren't able to get everybody that we wanted to talk to. So the lovely Jason Salke has been beavering away in the background for the last couple of weeks, with the result that we have all of the chosen men with us today for Sharp's Reunion Part 2. Whoop, whoop. This is going to be awesome. Yeah. Okay, so let's go round the virtual room because we're not breaking any laws. Firstly, our historian Zach is back. Hey, Zach.
Hi, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. We also have Marcus Cribbs, who is the manager at Apsley House, and another Sharp aficionado.
Hello.
Hey, Marcus.
Hey.
And we also have Adam Barnes with us, who's a member of the reenactors group, the 95th Rifles. Hey, Adam.
Hi, Alex.
They're basically here to fanboy over the rest of them. So we have, first off, we have Sergeant Daniel Hagman. Hello, John Tams.
Oh, good morning.
And how is lockdown, John?
Oh, it's all right. It's creaky, but I'm still trying to find the key.
Brilliant. It's fantastic to have you with us. We also have Lyndon Davis, Rifleman Ben Perkins.
Oh, how you doing?
How is lockdown for you? You're in Cheltenham, aren't you?
We are in Cheltenham. Yes, it's okay. It's not difficult. It's all right.
But you'd love your football back, is that right?
We do. We do miss a bit of football at the moment, that's for sure.
And the pub.
And the pub, yeah.
We also have with us Michael Mears, Rifleman Francis Cooper. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Francis Cooper. Picklock, of course. So if you're locked in, I'm your man.
Oh, we also have Paul Trussell, Rifleman Tom.
Hello. Lockdown's fine for me. It's going very well, thank you.
Southwest London, is that right?
Yeah, well, I'm down in the Wimbledon, in the Don, as I'm a borderline agoraphobic at the best of times, so you know, not really much change.
Brilliant. And of course, Jason is back. Hello, Jason.
Rifleman
Harris. You're a little
lovely
bit
to
excited,
be here. Thanks,
aren't
Alex.
You?
Thanks. Yeah, I'm very excited. I'm trying to hold myself down here. Lovely to see all of us together like this. Love you all. Mwah.
I love that you all bought props as well. Apart from Lyndon, you all appear to have bought props.
Put that sombrero on.
Lyndon,
I mean, Lyndon does have a sombrero on the back of his dining room door. I feel he's going to need to put it on at some stage. Right.
You know, Alex, in the first episode, Perkins had so few lines, Lyndon thought he was a prop.
Ouch, burn.
Not on Lyndon, not a burn on him.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, guys, we have so many questions that have come in. And as you rightly say, some of them are quite probing. This is going to be fun. Let's start with Guy Barfoot, because he asked, Jason, we already know this about you, but for the rest of you, did any of you have an interest in the Napoleonic era before you got cast in the series? Let's go to Paul.
Short answer is not really. I was listening to Jason and Sean in the previous podcast, and I was a bit more like Jason, I think, more of a sort of growing up in the 70s, it was all World War II stuff that was kind of capturing my imagination at that sort of time, movies like The Great Escape and stuff like that. So that was more my thing, really. Yeah, but I mean, you know, you get hooked along in it when we went off and did our manoeuvres with old Rifleman Richard Moore, and you just sort of fall in love with it, really, and cooking your sausages over a fire, that type of thing.
Brilliant. And Mike, what about you?
Not really. I think Paul nailed it. Yeah, one was just sort of very familiar with World War II and to a lesser extent World War I, but any sort of wars further back. Not really, although, you know, in my acting life, I do get to play a lot of period parts, maybe because of my schnoz, I don't know, my clothes. I look good. I don't look good in modern costume. I mean, I once played an ambulance man in a film, and I went to see the cast and crew screen. I thought I don't look like any ambulance man I've ever seen in my life. I just don't look like an ambulance man. But so once we started on Sharp, I did feel very at home in the period, and got to know a lot about it. Yeah, and as Paul says, yeah, sort of fell in love with the lifestyle to a degree.
Yeah, I mean, it sounded quite gritty, but I guess just hanging out with your mates and playing war is not the worst thing to do, is it, John?
I was very interested in the Napoleonic era before Sharp, and after Sharp, I had no interest whatsoever.
You've done it to death, is what you're saying.
No, I think most of the... If I'm inclined to think about myself as a musician and singer, then obviously that era around the time of the Napoleonic Wars was very rich in traditional culture. And I live about a mile away from Pentridge, where in 1817 was the last English revolution. So I'm keen on that. I've written a screenplay about that. And so, yeah, all that stuff. And then, of course, more recently, I've been involved with Warhorse at the National. So that was the Great War. So, I'm interested in war.
I feel it would be hugely ironic if Lyndon had the least lines of everybody and was the only one passionately in love with the Napoleonic era before you started filming.
Probably going to be disappointed by that one. Okay. hadn't read the books. And still haven't read the books or the Smiths, really. No, not at all. Unfortunately not. Didn't even know it happened.
Brilliant. I love your honesty. Paul, you've already mentioned the training. So from what Jason told us on the last show, you guys had a 2-week boot camp, didn't you, of all things Napoleonic. Lyndon, were you even listening?
Yeah. To that question.
No, in the workshop with Richard Moore.
Was I there?
Just to go back actually to what something Lyndon said, when we first went out there with the very, very first director, who was Jim Goddard, a wondrous great big giant of a man, lovely man, who was eventually replaced by Tom Clegg for reasons that I don't really know. But anyway, I remember getting out there into the Ukraine and sort of saying to Jim, so Jim, you know, I was probably sucking up a bit. I was like, so Jim, you must have read all the books. And they go, no, not taking the books, I'm making a film. I haven't read the books, only read the script, don't need to read the books. And I was like, fairly chastened. I just sort of walked off with my tail between my legs, you know.
It's funny you should say that, because I'd love to ask you guys, but at my audition, we didn't talk anything about Napoleonics, anything about Sharp, Bernard Cornwall, warfare, nothing. We just sat there talking about my dad.
Oh, yeah.
And my dad's a writer, and that's all he was interested in. So when I walked out the door, I thought, oh, fuck that. That's no one got that job. So, Jimbo.
I thought I was onto something because Jim said to me, show me your left profile, and I'll show you your right profile.
Wellington.
Could you move to the edge of the screen, the room, please, Michael, and then you might fit in.
Now, could you show me a reaction to...
an explosion so many miles away. Yeah.
Was that part of your audition process, guys? Show me your reaction to...
could have been, then I'd have been weeded out. You know?
That's a bit of an in-joke, actually, the reaction thing.
Yeah. Triple.
Well, it was about this. There's a bit in... Was it Rifles?
Dance Rifles.
Rifles, where the farmhouse blows up. And so they blew up the farmhouse, and then about 3 days later, they asked us to react to it as though we were watching it. And so I thought to myself, oh, God, this is one of those moments, those acting moments, you know, where you think, oh, you'll get all excited. I thought, no, the thing to do is do nothing and let the audience sort of read it on our face. And I think most of us got that memo. Didn't we?
Yeah, but in my case, I did the first part of Paul's sentence. I didn't do the second bit.
I could have to go back and watch your reaction to this farmhouse getting blown up.
In fairness to Michael Mears, I think we shot it in August, the blowing up with Paul McGann, and then we shot the reaction in Portugal 4 months later. Right, John?
4 months.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that was the case. We shot the reaction 4 months later in Portugal.
It's not my proudest moment on screen.
But out of that came this moment some days later where Dara referred to this. He said, oh, there he is over there having a Michael Mears moment. And this became known as a triple M. and a triple M was a reference to any kind of, you know, slightly overt piece of stagecraft.
Well, it actually, it derives from its double take. So you do a double take, but Mickey did a triple take. Although he didn't really, he didn't. But we named him Triple after that.
Oh, I love it. Anytime anyone overreacts to anything in my life, again, I'm going to call it a Michael Mears moment.
It's got to be a Triple M.
Triple M.
Okay.
Michael is known by all of us lot as Triple or Triple M.
Trip.
Okay. Anyway, let's get back to the point of the training.
Why?
Yeah, no, I'm just vaguely trying to have some semblance of control over this.
I don't think
people want it. Go on, Mike, answer that.
Well, I'll say something, and this refers to a later question about the recoil. I do remember Richard Moore, you know, our military advisor and trainer, taking us out to a field. Where was it? Somewhere in northwest London.
Holland and Holland.
Yeah, yeah. And putting gunpowder in the pan, yeah?
Mm. Yeah, and cardboard.
Yeah, all of that. And they put a load in mine. Just, he obviously must have thought, oh, you know, this guy needs a bit of shaking up. And it went off. Now, there's no recoil because we weren't firing a bullet, but phew, all this stuff went up into my eye and into my face. And he said, you know, that's what it's like. You know, that's what it's like. You've got to get used to that. And, but it was a constant thing during filming. We had to sort of remember to do the recoil because we weren't firing a bullet. And so often we'd forget, or one person would forget and two would remember. And I thought it was a bit of an issue, but I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think viewers watching it think, oh, he didn't recoil, there can't be a bullet.
I'm pretty sure Adam, Marcus and Zach do, but they're probably on their own. Yeah. You're lucky that not everybody's on that level.
In fact, very, very, very often, I mean, I only did the first two, but lads can tell you about the last ones, but very often the rifles didn't go off. I don't want to spoil the magic, but there's a bit where we're doing, for example, the salute, the gun salute over the grave of
Lennox.
Yeah, and I think we did it about four times, and in any of those takes, only about three of the guns went off, and it's so disappointing when you pull the trigger and it just went thap.
Especially after build up of the take, you know, action with positioning and the. And remember, Dara used to bet on how many would go off or how many wouldn't go off.
John, Dara, what do you remember?
Dara would bet on anything.
Yes.
John, what do Dara. You remember from the training? Wait, oh, he has a rifle. Did you nick that from the set? We thought Sean nicked everything.
And then you go like that.
Oh.
I fired Mr. Knopp, fully loaded once, to open an annual Fate Western Death nearby. And it was fully loaded with all barrels. And it blew me back about 5 yards. It was in a marquee. It set fire to the roof of the marquee. And all the fair contestants, rabbits and stoats and weasels and the like, shat themselves in, as a result of the explosion and me pulling backwards off. So I learned a lot from firing black powder weapons, and I think considering what they do, they're rather beautiful.
I just think you created that whole scenario to get out of the fate, if I'm honest. It's Machiavellian and brilliant.
Well, I remember the Holland and Holland because they are actually armourers. They are manufacturers of still rather beautiful fire pieces and shooting paraphernalia. And I enjoyed that. We did actually fire at balloons from about 10 paces, 15. And of course, with my air being so long, I usually set fire to my hair when we fired in the film, which was quite fun. And I think there's one scene where I fire two bakers at the same time. I mean, to do a sword fight.
My one abiding memory of Holland and Holland is I was so gung-ho. I thought I was like Falklands, like super soldier. And I popped a balloon and I marched up to Richard Moore and I saluted like Roddy McDowell in Oh Lucky Man. You know, and he said, "Don't get cocky, lad." And Lyndon was always telling me that all through the years, don't get cocky, lad.
Lyndon, what do you remember about training?
I remember the minibus drive there. That was it. I never actually realised until afterwards, after speaking to quite a few people, what an amazing place it was, to be honest. Because when I've spoken to people recently, where I said, oh, a similar sort of question, and they've been extremely impressed, whereas at the time I didn't have a clue where I was. So, a minibus ride, basically.
We were lucky, because the timing was like, if we'd been there now, we'd been annexed by Russia. And if we'd been in Turkey, where we were later on, we'd been on the Syrian border, not a place I'd recommend at the moment.
Actually, John, you know that the earthquake in Turkey 2 years after we were filming flattened our hotel, the Elmas. It flattened it at 2 a.m.
Oh, really?
Yeah, pancaked the whole thing. Had we been there then? It would be a total tragedy, or even more of a tragedy.
Well, it was, I mean, Ukraine was a little bit like Dodge, well, that bit of where we were, a bit like Dodge City anyway, because obviously the Union had just collapsed, hadn't it? The Soviet Union had just collapsed, and we were kind of first in. So yeah. What was a KGB colonel on Friday was a mafia gaffer on Monday. You still FSB. Got the plastic briefcase with the automatic pistol in it, but... So all the KGB colonels became mafia barons the following weekend.
They also became producers of Sharp.
Yeah. We actually got a question on the Soviet soldiers that you had as extras. Was that, I think it was along the lines of, is it intimidating that you, all your extras were ex-Soviet forces?
We were buying all their uniform.
Well, exactly. Exactly.
I'll answer their belts and their coats and their hats. It was great.
And other things.
They were about 17 years old. There was nothing to be intimidated. They were lads.
Mm. Yeah. It was finding the ones that were sober.
I must say, I was entranced by the whole fact that we were hanging out with the Red Army. These guys that had done Prague Spring, Nagorno-Karabakh, Afghanistan, all that stuff. Fascinated me. So I loved hanging out with those guys, talking to them, buying all their stuff.
Jason, was it when we had that speech from one of their senior officers telling us to actually stop buying the hats because they're running out of uniform?
Yeah, the colonel from Simferopol barracks, which is where these guys, young squaddies, as Paul said, 17-year-old grunts, they were stripping the barracks, not just of surplus, but of everything. And the colonel had to go to Malcolm and Muro via the Russian co-producer and say, please tell the actors to stop buying stuff from them, please.
Okay, this one is for our historians, just because, and I know they've been debating this online as well, because Ben Hodges asked, we've had a lovely demonstration on the video feed from John on how to work a rifle, if the Baker rifle was superior to the musket, guys, why not equip the whole army with them, or was it a case of being too difficult or too expensive?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one, because Adam will know more, but the Experimental Corps of Riflemen were formed to develop the tactics. Different units had different rifles coming in, but they were really expensive. And I think the gist of it was that the rifles at the time were a bit cutting edge and were trialing this weapon, and it was new technology. It was too expensive to roll out to everyone. And also, the tactics at the time had taken hundreds of years of developments going back way before Marlborough. So, it was too radical to develop and change everything at the time. But Wellington, particularly, loved the rifleman. In fact, there's a nice little link that after Wellington, died, the rifle brigade, as they became, formed the Guard of Honour during his funeral through London. So there's a nice link between the 95th going through with Wellington there.
Is it true, Marcus, that Napoleon was offered the rifles before Wellington and said, nah, it's too, I fight perfectly well, I don't need that stuff. Is that true?
I believe so. I believe that not the Baker rifles it became, because that was a British manufacturer, but they were developing rifles and he didn't want his troops having it. They were expensive and he liked this big columns. I think they talk about it in Sharp, that rat-a-tat-tat and marching forwards and chanting and... that was their elan, their spirits of the French fighting, and they did things differently to us.
But also you've got the fact that it's a different recruiting base, isn't it? Because with the levée en masse and with more and more of French society just kind of being drawn into the army at large, you know, you've got to kind of keep these badly trained recruits kind of moving, and the rifle's a different kind of concept. It's about hunting out your opponent and thinking independently, and that's kind of not Napoleon's way of war, but also then he doesn't like the fact that it's too long a reload, so that you've got multiple things kind of influencing that.
Mm. And distance, I suppose distance too, you know, you can, the Baker was better at longer range. Also, rifling a barrel is really quite a technological thing to ask. You've got a smooth bore with the Brown Bess, and then you've got a rifle barrel with the Baker. The rifling is extremely complicated and expensive, as you gentlemen say.
In fact, there's a point, and I shouldn't say it's funny, but it's a bit ironic that a French general in the peninsula, when fighting against the riflemen, had to write a letter back to Napoleon saying it's not exactly very sporting. They keep killing all our officers, and it's not fair.
Yeah, I'm from a distance.
There's another interesting fact, Zach, and maybe Marcus can confirm this. Stevenson's rocket went to Ezekiel Baker to ask about how to bore metal for his trains. Is that also true? Because if that's the case, then that's like Industrial Revolution from Baker rifle kind of thing, yeah?
I believe I've heard that because the Ezekiel Baker, when he was designing it, had such good rifling techniques in his factories. But
pretty cool.
It's because you didn't have interchangeable parts back then. If you lost the spring on your rifle, you wouldn't be able to go to the store and just get another spring. You'd have to make another one that just fitted that exact point. So you couldn't swap things over, like you would go down buy a bag of nuts and bolts and they all fit each other. It wasn't like that.
Lock, stock and barrel, I suppose.
Yeah. All together.
Okay, guys, let's go back to the show. Let's go round the room on this one, because we have a question from Craig Johnson, who asks, let's start with Paul. What's your favourite episode that you did? And if you could change anything, I so know what Jason's answer is going to be to that. What would you change? Paul, you start.
Oh, well, I've not watched them for a while, but I'm in accord with Sean Bean on this. I do think Eagle is my, Shots Rifles is my favourite. Sean summed it up really well, I thought, in the other podcast. You know, it's really raw and I don't know, it's just got a great thing about it. If I could change something, I don't know, I'd maybe try and stop Dara standing in front of me in a lot of
Oh, he's going to regret not coming on this so much,
isn't he? But no, I don't really have any regrets. I really liked it and all that, you know, when Sean comes up and that bit where he finds the guy asleep and then I stick the rifle in Sean's head. And he, you know, all that. I love all that. That's all,
yeah.
The fab entrance for me, I felt, you know.
Jason, I know you. You're going to say, I wish I hadn't been killed off.
You know what? More heart rendering was the death of Perkins for me. Because by the time Waterloo came along, I was thoroughly disenchanted with the management of Sharp.
Okay.
Finally.
This was ultimate. I was really thinking of not doing the fifth show, but you know, because I was such a petulant little baby. Anyway, I would say that Waterloo dying in that was pretty cool. I thought that was a pretty cool thing and interesting, and it didn't feel terrible. And it was the last ever episode, so I was kind of cool with that. Well, I thought it was the last one anyway. But I thought the death of Linda Perkins was, terrible. Awful.
Oh, he was so little and cute, wasn't he? You can't kill off the little cute one.
I know, and it's pretty unnecessary as well.
I think that's
but my favourite episodes are like Sean and like Poplito said there. I love Rifles, Eagle, Honour, and even Enemy. I loved all that first lot where most of us were running around.
Mike?
Yeah, well, anything.
Would you change the Triple M?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I'd also change how I left the show. I would like to have done more, but I wasn't in the right place at that time to do more. I'd been ground down by the experience that year, and you know, my dad had died and everything. I was a million miles from home, and I felt like the chosen men were being given less and less to do. But I wish that I'm a completely different person now, believe me, honestly, I am. It's the only thing in my professional career where I thought, I wish I had stuck it out, actually. I only had like a week of my contract left. I wish I had stuck it out, and I would like to have, you know, calmed down, got over that, and then come back and done a bit more.
Died at Waterloo.
Yeah, I guess so. Favourite episodes, unquestionably, I think anything with Postlethwaite in. So, I mean, you know, you're talking Enemy and, you're talking Company and,
Enemy
and Company, yeah. I mean, I love Sharp's Rifles for the reasons that have been said so far, because we were introduced and set up so well. But I thought Postlethwaite brought something so special to those two episodes, and indeed Assunta and, you know, all the other cracking actors that were on board. Yeah, those were my favourites.
John, what about you?
It's difficult because I didn't know who these characters were. Mm. But it seemed in Rifles, for example, that neither did they. Well, I made up a lot of background for them, and strangely enough, the director filmed it. So I decided where Jason came from, where Harris came from, for example, and that he was a courtier to my Lord Bacchus.
I do remember that, yeah.
I may have decided that Michael was, don't know where, and we heard that you were a picklock. Well, how did I, and Paul just said army. That's all he could say. He just kept saying army. Where are you from? And he just said army, I think. Is that right, Paul?
Yeah, army, sir. Just army. Brilliant.
Brilliant piece of writing and acting.
Just army. And your family? Army. And I thought that was, that scene wasn't in.
I know.
We haven't got any backstory at all. We were just ciphers. We were just green ciphers. Mm. When you were talking about expressions and how to do a reaction, I only found out recently that I can only react on one side of my face because that's the edge of the frame that I was always placed on. I never got to be in the picture. So I only worked the left-hand side of my face. No, I thought the... anything with Postlethwaite, who was the greatest actor in the world. Yeah. Not so long ago, I got to work with Spielberg, and at the end of the shoot, he came across and said...
That name for you, John.
Pardon?
I'll just get that name for you there, John.
At the end of the shoot, the reason I'm saying this, you'll see in a second. At the end of the shoot, he came across and said, you're a friend of Pete Postlethwaite's, aren't you? I said, yes, and you are too, because you think he's the greatest actor you've ever directed. And he said, yes, he is. He said, will you tell him he's got a part in my next film? I said, no, you tell him, Stephen. No, I want you to tell him because you're his friend. It would be a nice thing to do. I said, well, that's really generous.
Charitable. What film was that?
It was Lincoln.
Ah.
Yeah. Mm. Dante Lewis. Yeah.
Yep.
And by the time I had rung Pete, he died.
Mm. Oh. So much outpouring of love from all you guys
quality,
and Sean as
that's
well.
The quality of Spielberg as well, that he wanted a friend of his to tell him that he got a part in Lincoln.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
I thought that was very moving.
Oh. Lyndon, what was your favourite episode and what would you change? Do you even remember being in Sharp? I'm starting to doubt.
What was the program we're talking about again? Sorry.
Singing just like,
Bye Bye Baby.
Yeah, get a video. I'll go with the Postlethwaite ones like everybody else because they are just, I mean, he's legendary, they're legendary, and so on. I like Gold, even though no one else does. Purely because I think it's the one we're in the most. So we might not do a lot. We do a lot of walking through fields and across places. But yeah, I liked it because it was actually, I don't think they had any other actors in it apart from us, so it's all right.
Don't forget Rosie.
Shame. Pardon?
Don't forget Rosie. Remember? What? Irish Rosie. Rosie?
Oh, she really liked me.
Yes, us.
Yeah,
she blamed us for everything.
Mike, you've talked about why you left, but Ollie Davis did ask, he said, one question I have is what happened to Tung and Cooper's characters? If memory served, they just disappeared. So, Paul, what happened to you?
Well, you remember there's a bit where he says, not now, Jezebel. So he's saying, implying by that, later, Jezebel. So that's where he goes.
Nicely done. I know Adam wants to know this one as well. Michael Kirby asks, what is everyone's favourite quote, quip or one-liner from the series? He likes Lieutenant Price's, I'm acting adjutant, oh, I ain't any longer.
I'll start. I love... I love the lines that Mr. Tams wrote for me. I can read, sir. but which I write down a lot when I'm signing autographs, but one I used to really love with Sean was when he said a bloody air trumpets, so we would always that, but instead of the B word we'd add the F word. But the ultimate one, which I love and I say over and over, is the lines between Brian Cox and Sean, and Brian says and Sean says, you expect me to rise up for a rag on a pole? You do, Richard, you do. I love that for some reason.
Mike?
Right. Well, it's so obvious, isn't it? I mean, I love Sean's line, Jules, and then I bloody choose you. And my own favourite line, of course, is, ticket to leave, sir, just clapped eyes on me supper. When I spot the rabbit over there and I go, or the hare rather, and I go and bag it, and I have to get a ticket to leave the march off Sean, and off I go, shoot it, come back with it. So yeah, clapped eyes on my supper. Yeah, and I'm looking at the clock, and I've sort of clapping the eyes on my lunch in about an hour. Anyway, carry on.
John, what about you?
Hmm?
What's your favourite one-liner or quote from the show? Yeah,
Poss, always. Yeah, Peter Postlethwaite. Pete Postlethwaite saying, "Eons." Do you remember that? Eons. Eons. November the 5th, 1900, and frozen to death. The set caught fire. Actually,
yes, there was a sharp sword.
And I was off duty. I was to the set to try and solve the problem of the burning set, which was still smouldering. And I thought, I know what to do. So I came back to the place, the Vardia place. Mausoleum, and I wrote a scene so they could, because it was burnt down, they couldn't shoot on the 360, which you need for a sword fight, and there was a sword fight at the conclusion, and we were to fly to Lisbon. So if we hadn't finished filming, we were going to be there for about another 3 or 4 weeks while they rebuilt the fort. So I'd been out with Sean a few times in Sheffield and so on, and we'd had a lager or two, and you know, he can use his hands, can Sean? He's got very fast hands, and I've heard him say this before, so I put it in the script, which is it says to the French officer, "He's going to have a sword fight with outside now." And that's my favourite line, because I just don't say it. I really remember that one. We flew to Lisbon the following day, and it saved £50,000, me writing that scene. And I got to Lisbon, and the producer said, come and have lunch, I want to talk to you about what you've been doing. And I went to have lunch with him. I remember I had liver and onions, and a nice bottle of Shiraz. And that was it.
So none of the
£50,000
went your way
then? I got paid. Living onion and a bottle of Shiraz, and I'd say 50K.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
It was the first meal, John. I
agree with Jason. It was a pleasure being killed at Waterloo.
Yeah.
Lyndon, what about you?
The amazing stunt fly, Johnny. The amazing stunt fly that landed on our hand, remember?
That's right.
Amazing,
yeah. Yeah, and you took at least 15 goes to get stabbed in the back. Wasn't your fault. And the touching thing was Sean wasn't working that day, but he turned up to watch us both get killed. Never mind.
you're saying that Jason made a meal out of his death scene. I don't believe you. No, impossible.
Jason was spot on every time. He fell exactly on the sixpence. But the other guy was either a yard behind him or too many feet in front. And we shot it about at least a dozen times, didn't we, before he got it right. And you were happy with it.
Yeah.
And then I went all camp and got you to crawl out and hold my hand.
What it was, John, was one of the stuntmen, Igor, Ukrainian stuntman, was my buddy for years, all years, and he didn't want to nail me with the musket. I had a massive pad in my back. He said, "Just hit me hard, please." And he was giving me little, "Oh, I can't heal Jason, no." And that's why it took so long.
Good man, but it'd take a while, didn't it?
It did take a while. I saw Igor in Kiev last year. He says hello to you all, guys. Oh, bless all you guys.
Yeah, he's a good man.
He's a good man.
No, but it was difficult at the time.
It was. It was.
Lyndon, do you remember any lines from Sharp?
No.
Nothing new there then.
No. No, I honestly can't even remember a single line.
Paul, what about you?
You must know that Lyndon was the major star of The Chosen Man. When he arrived, he was a high-flying wonder kid.
Yes.
Having just done...
And when I left, John, what was I when I left?
What had you done before then?
Singing detective.
Singing detective was the first thing when I was 13.
And you were a major in that.
Was quite a rather large thing, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah. So from after Sharp, it just went downhill, didn't it?
Paul, if you could stop laughing, what's your favourite one-liner?
Can I have three?
Yeah, go for it.
One of my favourites is one that Dara said, actually, and it's you wouldn't necessarily notice it, but it became a bit of a running joke for us after he'd said it. And it's a scene where Paul Bigley gets whipped, and Sean whips out some brandy, a pint of brandy. To give him some brandy, Pat. And Dara says, "Here, son," and he puts the canteen in the kid's mouth. He says, "There you go, pint of brandy, half in your belly and half on your back." And that became a bit of a slightly dirty joke, but I'm not going to go any further on that one. My favourite line that I had was, and actually a lot of this was down to the reaction from my dear friend Lyndon there, which was "Yay, I say yay" at the funeral, and the hilarious response Perkins gives me to that. I love that. and so that's my favourite one. And the favourite line I heard, which is a bit naughty, but which wasn't in the thing, but I heard someone say, was because I was reminded of it when John was talking about his liver and onions, and he was making quite light of it. But of course, while we were filming, John got quite poorly and lost a ton of weight. And I remember one day I was sat next to Sean, and he just said, and John walked by, and Sean just went, "Oh, hey, look at John's hands. He's so fucking thin, you can't fucking see him." There you go. You're probably behind Dara.
Oh, I love it. So we've already talked about death scenes. So Rad has asked about some of the famous actors that weren't famous. Obviously, you were much more famous at the time, but those buggers have gone on to be bigger than you in some ways, I guess. One being Daniel Craig, which is what Rowan Kendrick specifically asked about. Exactly who. What was it like working with Daniel Craig on Sharp's Eagle? And I put in Mark Strong as well. I love him as a British bad guy in that. Did you have any inkling that these people were going to go on to sort of Hollywood stuff? And also, were they complete divas to work with?
Do you want me to start, boys?
Yeah, go on.
Okay, as soon as I saw Daniel Craig, I thought, wow, that dude is like a young Steve McQueen, and I reckon something's going to happen. But he was so arrogant and looking down his, I loved it, I loved arrogant looking down his, and didn't suffer fools gladly. And he's exactly the same now. He has not changed a jot. Right. So when I saw him, I knew that. Mark Strong, very lovely, lovely chap. He was big in theatre. But the one person I thought I knew was going to be a star is Paul Bettany. Reminds me of Paul Trussell a little bit as well sometimes. He was hilarious. He was
Paul Trussell's better looking, obviously.
Of course.
Thank you.
And a bigger kid, apparently.
Especially with that wig on. For those that don't know, Paul emerged onto this recording session wearing basically a Britney Spears wig and claiming that he hasn't been able to get to a hairdresser. He's got it back on now. He looks like the blonde guy from Wayne's World, basically.
Wayne's World.
Sorry, Jason.
I'll just finish up. Yeah. So Paul Bettany was on all the time. It was his first job, I think. But he's naturally really funny and witty. I don't think they've ever tapped into that in movies. It's kind of weird, but anyway.
Definitely not in the Da Vinci Code. He just spent that one flogging himself, didn't he?
Yeah, but he's really light and funny and sparkly. He's fantastic. I mean, if you get the Harris Video Diaries episode 10 and 9, you'll see that.
Oh, what a plug. Nicely done. Mike, what about you?
I wasn't quite so blown away by Daniel as Jason was, but I was very struck by his eyes, those incredible blue eyes. But I know that Daniel, didn't suffer fools gladly. He also didn't suffer alarm clocks very gladly. particularly Lyndon Davis's alarm clock. So I'm in my room, and there was Lyndon's room, and then there was Daniel's room on that particular year. And I don't know where Lyndon was in the middle of the night and in the early morning. But he left his alarm clock in his room.
In my defence, can I just defend myself? Every day there was a power cut when we were out filming, and the alarm clock reset itself to midnight. It was a 5.99 Argos alarm clock.
Daniel Craig went on the war path. He was going up and down the coast. Where's Lyndon? I'm going to bloody break into his...
Extraordinary.
Michael, this was the third night of the week it had got off. The first night, Brian Cox found me and said, Lyndon, I think your alarm's going off. You think you need to come up and switch it off? And every day, I'd switch it off. We'd go to work the next day. The power cut would happen. I would not know. I was down in the bar having a shandy every night. And then by about the Thursday, Daniel Craig climbed over the balcony, broke into my hotel room, took my alarm clock, threw it over the balcony, and broke it. And I was deeply upset.
So what you're saying is Daniel Craig owes you $5.99.
Yes, $5.99, and I'll take £6.
And an apology.
No, I don't know. I don't want him to apologize.
Paul, what about you?
Just give me £6.
I can't remember what you asked. I'm so sorry.
The famous people that came out of Sharp.
Oh, well, I had a lot of fun with Neil Dudgeon, who, of course, went on to be...
Shady.
What was that?
Shady.
Him and Michael Cochran were called the Booze Brothers.
Yeah, Michael Cochran, Simerson, of course, and Neil Dudgeon were just such amazing value. I think all the chaps will agree, particularly Cochrane, who was called Cocky. He spent sort of the whole time he was there living off cigarettes and alcohol, essentially. I never took me. And it was just an absolute delight. And I was very lucky. I worked with Michael a few times now, and he's just one of those people when you see and your eyes light up. Daniel Craig, yeah. I mean, he just sort of looked right through me, as I recall. He didn't, as Jay says, really, he didn't really have any sort of time for me, as I recall.
But you were more famous than he was at this point, right? Let's just get that in there.
Yeah, and I used to tell him that, but for some reason, he got the right arseache about it and went off and became James Bond.
Neil Dudgeon, I've just Wikipedia him, and I know who you're talking about, because I was watching actually a back episode of Silent Witness last night, and he was the snotty detective in that. Guys, if you do Google him, you'll see his face and you'll go, oh, that guy, because he's been in loads.
Midsummer Murders.
Yeah, and he was in Sherlock Holmes, the one with Rupert Everett, wasn't it? He was Lestrade.
Yeah, I mean, he's not on, you know, obviously he's not Daniel Craig level, but he's, you know, really done well over here and stuff. And he's just a great guy and really good fun. I remember going once to a, do you remember this, Jace? We went to a market in the Ukraine and he came back with an enormous illuminated gondola.
Is that the one where Sean Bean bought the hammer for half a pence that he still uses every day?
Very likely, yeah, very likely. The Simferopol Bazaar, the Yalta Bazaar.
Oh, I feel like I have to go there. Right.
No, good luck.
Yeah. Okay, do you know what? I love this question. If the Sharp books were being adapted for a newer audience, who would you want to play you in the reboot? Also, who would you want to play other characters such as Wellington and do you know what? I don't think you ever could. Let's not recast Pete Postlethwaite's character. Let's leave it for Pete. No. But who would you have? Mike, you could be Wellington, couldn't you?
Absolutely. Al? I'd love to, yeah. I mean, I wasn't really properly cast as a Cockney picklock, even though I am a Londoner. But I always felt I should really have been playing one of the officers, but then I wouldn't have got to hang out for 5 or 6 films.
You've got more lines, though.
Yes, indeed, yeah. I'd love to see... I would like to have seen John taking on my role, because I think he'd have brought something very interesting to it, to Cooper. He'd have found something in it that that maybe I didn't find, failed to find.
No. What about now? Who would you have now?
Now? Can I think about that? I'll come back to you in a moment.
Yeah, no, he's got an answer.
Macaulay Culkin.
Yeah. I love it. Years have not been kind to Macaulay Culkin either. If he's listening, sorry, dude, but you can't hide from it.
A lot of people say I look like Jared Harris.
I know, I worked with him once.
Yeah, do I look like him?
A little bit, but you're far more good looking and charismatic.
From the back, Jason.
From the back.
From the back, thank you.
Oh, John, who would you have play you?
Oh.
He's thinking. He's got his thinking man pose.
It's a thinking pose.
Yeah.
Johnny?
Oh, me? Yeah, what? You're asking me?
Yeah, what if someone was going to play your role now, who would it be?
I'd do it myself.
Excellent. Yeah. I like that answer.
I'd do it myself. I'd be... even older and grayer, but I'd do it myself, providing I could keep my moustache.
Willie Nelson could play Hagman. Willie Nelson.
Yeah, Nellie Wilson, whatever his name is.
Yeah.
Oh, what about you? Daniel Craig?
No. No, he's not tall enough. I think it would be a toss-up between Joaquin Phoenix or Michael Mears, I feel. a cross between the two. Ideally.
What about Stephen Merchant?
Merchant? Yes. Yes. Potentially Merchant. A sort of Merchant Joaquin Phoenix hybrid.
Mm. That is Bethany. A terrifying thought, yeah.
I wish I'd got the job as Perkins, to be honest.
Mike, who do you reckon? You've had some time to think.
I haven't come up with anything yet.
he's still holding that pose. He's still got that look.
Yeah, I've worked with Hugh Grant a couple of times. He's too old, really, but I'd like to see him take on Cooper.
I think
I'd like to see Hugh Grant's Triple M.
He played Cooper in Paddington 2, didn't he?
Oh, right. Just a quick one for the historian.
Stanley Tucci could have played Cooper.
Nice choice. Like it.
Good I thought you'd like it.
Just a quick one for the guys. We heard about your football and what it did to Paul McGann. Well, it sounds like he kind of did it to himself, unfortunately. But James has asked, the football scenes in Sharp, were they planned or was this another improv where you were just like, let's just see if this works? And Zach, is there any record of them playing sports, etc. in their downtime? What did the higher-ups think on it?
When did we play football?
Beginning of Enemy.
Was I in it?
Yeah. So only Poplito wasn't there.
But we didn't rehearse that, did we, Chase?
No, I mean, well, no, just we didn't even know it was happening until the morning it was there, because they never gave us a script.
Was I any good, Chase?
You were like Ryan Giggs, don't you remember?
Yeah, obviously not.
No, it was like a hybrid rugby football tough sort of bizarre game.
Didn't it get cut?
No, it was in there, but it was kind of replicating the moment where Tim Bentinck and Julian Fellows come upon Harper and Sharp scrapping on the floor. So this is where
I remember it now.
Rolls up and we're like in a ruck.
And it was a pig's bladder, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's as clear as something.
Yeah, Sharp's enemy, beginning scene, Lord Fartingdale pops in and goes, "Ow, disgusting oinks, playing sports, yeah."
Right, Zach, sounds good.
Zach, is that realistic?
I've been racking my brains about this, because the officers, there's quite a lot of detail about them going hunting. So Wellington had a pack of hounds, which he used to go out daily during the early part of 1813 to try and kind of recover from a pretty awful campaign. But I can't think off the top of my head of any records of the men playing football or anything kind of similar to it.
Nor could Lyndon, yeah.
We're in this together, my friend, nor could I.
They spent plenty of time gambling, but from the memoirs, it looks like they spent more of their time drinking and chasing the local ladies rather than sort of playing sport.
Lyndon remembers that, yeah. Okay, let's do one more round the table, and then I've just got a music question, and I want to bring Adam in to talk about the 95th Rifles. So one question that came up numerous times was, what is your favourite memory, or in Lyndon's case, any memory of being on set for Sharp?
I'll come back to me. I'm about to think about this one.
Jason, I know you'll know.
Yeah, straight away what comes to mind is defending Santiago de Compostela at Torre Castro, and we raised the Gonfalon, and all of those scenes leading up to us retreating into the churchyard. There's a lull in the fighting, a priest and a chorister walks through the battle. It's just a wonderful scene, you know. Tongue gets hit in the leg, lots of little stunts. It was a real togetherness scene, and I loved it. Obviously, it's episode ending, but that comes to mind, the raising of the Gonfalon at Torre Castro.
Paul?
I think I really enjoyed that time when we were on the bridge.
Mm.
That was fun, I remember. You boys, Lyndon and Jace, were underneath wiring gunpowder up, I remember. And I think I was on watch or something. And it was just great. And then didn't the French all come running over the bridge? And we sort of ran at them. And I remember slamming some extra, not very pleasant of me, in the chest with my hand. And he went flying. And we just... I mean, I didn't mean, you know, he was okay. I just should say he wasn't hurt.
Was it an extra or was it Daniel Craig?
In my mind, it was Daniel Craig. but it was an. I knew it was an extra because he was tall with Daniel Craig. I love you, Daniel, if you're listening.
It was a stuntman, probably.
Yeah, I think it was a stuntman. Yeah, I think
it was a 17-year-old Russian.
Yeah, but then on that the whole time on that bridge was really, really cool, and Tom, dear old Tom Clegg, was absolutely brilliant, and he was hopping around in the water and getting all different shots. It was really, really fun, and then the craziness of watching that bridge get blown up, you know, actually not a computer, it was
twice.
Blown up, and they really
twice.
That's right, they rebuilt it. You're right, James. Why did they do it twice?
One for Paul, one for Sean.
Okay, one for Paul McGann, one for Sean, yeah. But that's my... I've got lots of happy memories, but that's my main one.
Where did they get the Semtex from?
It's the Soviet Union.
Yalta Bazaar. John, what's your favourite memory on set?
I like the fact that I was such a good shot. I could shoot a cavalry officer on Monday and he wouldn't fall off his horse till the following Thursday. I underline how brilliant a shot I was. And how slow the ball comes out the end of the Baker rifle. It took 4 days to get to the shot. laughed a lot. And sometimes it fell off before I shot him. He may have shot, it probably fell off on Friday, and then I had to wait to shoot him on Monday. I quite like that. And I offset, my favourite one is we went next door when we were in Turkey to have some chips, Sean and I, and he they were lovely chips, and they arrived, and he looked up and said, have you got any vinegar? And the guy explained, and you can't explain vinegar, incidentally, in any way. And he explained vinegar to this lovely Turkish guy. And I was sitting next to him, and there was a big tree of lemons. So I took some lemons off the tree and chopped them up and squeezed them on my chips. Yeah, you can't have lemon on your chips, he said. And I put some salt on. And then he said, give us a chip then. So I give him one of mine, having enjoyed them. And he said, oh, blimey, these are good. And to this day, Sean Bean still has lemon on his chips.
Really?
Because I know he hates mayonnaise.
Yeah, but it we've got no vinegar. No, it's tinged to vinegar. It was lemon juice. That's where I lost the fiddle. I had a fiddle in some episodes, and it got stole that very day. While
I'm pretty sure it was Sean Bean. He seems to have everything from the set in his house. Lyndon.
Hello.
Go on, favourite memory on set?
That's a difficult one, really. I do remember actually going there. I think it's the whole thing, to be honest. It's the guys, I mean, we haven't seen or spoken to each other for donkeys, some of us, and we've come back today, and it's like we haven't been away. You know, it's like the whole sort of camaraderie of it and the way we got on. We went to hell and back and then back again while making it, and I don't think I can pick up one specific favourite scene. It's just the whole emotion to me was such a roller coaster ride. Mm. Some good, some bad, some worse than bad, some brilliant, some shocking, but it ended up in a decent program.
What about the tavern scene in Eagle?
Yeah, I don't poorly. Every one of us got poorly at some point, quite seriously poorly.
Yeah, we talked about that on the podcast with Sean, because you actually lost your first Wellington, didn't you? And I think, Jason, you did say that perhaps the medical care wasn't what it should have been in terms of dysentery and other realistic 18th century ailments that you were coming down.
We weren't crapping every Thursday evening at 8 p.m.
The drinking of vodka helped. That was the only medicine that we had with.
Mike, what was your favourite memory on set?
Well, yeah, there are lots, but I suppose my favourite ones revolve around the non-fighting moments. So, for example, the big feast in Rifles. Mm. Rifles, load! And we all just got stuck into all this nosh. Really enjoyed that scene. I mean, we shot it twice, because we shot it once. Wasn't that our very first day in Stanford with Paul McGann?
Yeah, wow, right. Yes.
We had to reshoot it in, was that in Portugal, Chase?
Yeah, Portugal.
Another lovely moment. I love the birth of the baby, and I remember me looking through the tent, and Tansy saying, blankets, Cooper, blankets. And
not with human childs.
Yeah, lovely tender scene.
Lovely scene.
I also remember us doing the famous Rifles March, you know, three walk, three trot.
Quick time, dawdling time.
Through that hot valley somewhere, I can't remember which one it was, but we go, you know.
I know.
It's one bottle of water between 20 people.
Yeah. So those are three of my favourite moments.
Excellent. So you guys, these two shows that we've done have completely, it seems, reignited people's passion for Sharp. Because Adam, aren't you now reforming or reopening the Sharp Appreciation Society? And you guys, actually, you and I think Marcus are part of the 95th Rifles, aren't you? So Sharp has really sort of gone on for a new generation, because you're not of an age that you would have watched them as an adult and then started reenacting, are they? You've come to it later.
Yeah, absolutely. I came to it, I think my first reenacting event was actually with Jason, Lyndon and John in Nottingham for the Sharp Chefs book signing. That's what got me into it. Yeah, it was Waterstones. I remember running around Nottingham getting CDs for for several of the ladies for Donstein. That was really what got me into it. I was in the middle of doing my dissertation at university, and I was doing it on the 95th and got invited up to help out. And then that was sort of my way of sort of researching sort of what they were doing. So yeah, for me, Sharp was definitely a way into the hobby. The other part of the question was about Sharp Appreciation Society, wasn't it? I have been one of the groups on Facebook, Sharp's Rifles group, and there's been a lot of posts coming up since we've been in lockdown of people rifling through their stuff, finding, oh, here's my Sharp Appreciation Society card. There's so much love still for it that it's got me thinking, would it be a good idea to reform? Because there's so much love for it still.
You must dedicate it to Christine if you do.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised how much it comes up in a context for history, and the line between fact and fiction, and the amount of people think that Sharp and the Chosen Men really were there because they've read it so many times and watched it.
If every event we go to, when we march past, they're like, oh, it's Sharp and the Chosen Men. It's like, no.
No, they weren't real.
We must thank Adam, because Adam formed the first Facebook Sharps Rifles Facebook group, which is massive. And Adam started that, and it's helped to stoke the legend. So well done, Adam.
Well done, Adam.
Okay, one last question. I think it's for John. What was your favourite piece of music recorded for the show? And if you can pick one song that didn't make the cut, what would it be?
There wasn't a song that didn't make the cut.
Okay.
Because most of them were done on camera, you see. And if the scene got cut, probably the song did, but it didn't. They were all kind of useful, because they advanced time and so on, and gave a sense of what we were doing on downtime. There was one. I remember we were marching out of a fort towards the Mediterranean somewhere, and there was no time to teach a song. So I sang, when the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, and some more eggs. And we all marched to that. But I would like to have stayed in for Dean Martin's sake. But I can't think of a favourite one. Love Farewell probably was probably my favourite, which was actually taken off an album, but Tom Clegg decided to use it when Sean's having to leave his home in France and go back and have a scrap. Mm. And I recorded it sometime later for Out for Heroes with the Band and Bugles of the Rifle Regiment, which was a nice thing to be involved with, and I'm honoured to have done that.
Hey, John, I'm a little bit disappointed you didn't say that it was Tongue singing To Be a Pilgrim.
So, you know what, Paul, I was thinking of that when someone else was speaking, and it is actually the truth that you gave to that, the honesty and the authenticity, was magnificent. I think it's probably the best piece of singing in the whole series. Seriously, it's really good, because it's a night scene, and you're on picket, on duty, on sentry, and because we didn't know. I mean, Tong had an army and a kind of Rosicrucian belief in a weird religion as well. He was kind of eerie. I like that mystery about him. You know?
Thank you.
It was good.
I remember you, John, I would sing this To Be a Pilgrim. I'm not one of life's natural singers, and I'd be singing it, trying to get it in my head, and John coached me again and again and again. No, it's To Be a, you know, in his wonderful way, and he coached me.
I'm in a row at the moment with Alexander Armstrong and Alfie Bow. Alexander, both recorded Over the Hills and Far Away. Yeah.
Oh.
They both recorded it with my words and so on. And they both sing it in posh voices. Now, Alexander Armstrong is posh. But Alfie Bowes from Fleetwood in Lancashire, and he talks like me.
Yeah.
So why is he singing it in this non-existent voice that show singers have? It's not a real voice. Now, the beauty of that was when Paul sang To Be a Pilgrim, he sang it as tongue. He sang it in a vernacular voice. And it breaks your heart if you hear that sort of honesty. Now, if Alfie Bowes sung it like a soldier, in a soldier's voice, in his Fleetwood voice, I wouldn't have said anything, but I wrote to him, gave him bollocking, didn't get anything.
But you said your piece.
I can answer him at the moment because there's no credits on it. There's no credits on any of them. But, you know.
Can I say my favourite songs? Yeah. I love Poor Old Soldier because we used to adapt the lyrics and say, if ever I sign for Sharp's Rifles again, I'll need my head examined. And I loved, seriously, when Scott and Johnny sang, Hearts of Oak are our men, Hearts of Oak are our ships. That was beautiful. And then Mickey Mears singing the Old Bailey song.
I didn't sing that.
Oh, no, just
Hearts of Oak. I didn't.
Yeah, Price, Scott.
Yeah.
Sorry, John. I gave you credit where it wasn't you.
I railed against that because it's an art song. It's not a people song.
It was quite beautiful though.
It was written, whereas all the other stuff that we sang was just found. It was
passed down. Yeah.
Yeah, it was found.
But I didn't like Sharp's Company. I didn't like Sharp's Company anyway.
No. No.
What was it, Jason? The Michael Mears one that you liked?
The Old Bailey song, Mickey.
Oh, yeah. That was a found song, wasn't it, John?
Pardon?
That was a found song.
All Judges and Juries, Michael.
Yeah. Yes.
Justice and Old Bailey too. You sang it magnificently. It's a great song.
Love that.
I think we should all have sung a lot more, you know, not just me, and it would have been great. But Sharp the musical beckons.
It does. If Andrew Lloyd Webber is listening. Right, yeah. Okay.
Baz Luhrmann should do it.
I think that would be... Marcus, Zach, Adam, thank you so much for joining us. You didn't really get a word in edgeways, but I'm really glad that you were able to be here to interject with some history and also to tell the guys how much they're still loved.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure. The history is still very much alive and it's intertwined, so it's lovely to be involved. Thank you.
No problem. And we will get you three back, I think, to do a proper history show on it, because we've talked about the TV show a lot, but perhaps not covered the history behind it. So thanks very much.
Great. That'd be fantastic.
So just before we go, guys, and for the love of me, I cannot find the original post to give this lady her due credit, but we had a message from a lady who's an ICU nurse who's on the front line at the moment fighting coronavirus, and she asked if you would possibly sing Over the Hills to cheer her up. And I spoke to John beforehand, and we're going to give it a go, Zoom pending. So this is for you.
Here's 40 shillings on the drum. For those who volunteer to come to list and fight the foe today, over the hills and far away, o'er the hills and o'er the main,
through Flanders, Portugal and Spain,
King George commands and we obey,
over the hills and far away. If duty calls us, we must go to stand, face another foe. Yes, we will stand and we will stay, and the NHS will win the day. O'er the hills and o'er the main,
through Flanders, Portugal and Spain,
King George commands and we obey,
over the hills and far away, o'er the hills and o'er the main, through Flanders, Portugal and Spain, King George commands and we obey, over the hills and far away.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks for organising this.
No, guys, exactly. Thanks, Jason, for getting you all together.
Good job. Bye, guys.
I love you a lot, and it's good to see you and looking so well. Keep safe.
Thank you.
After one another.
I have a sneaky suspicion that we've not heard the last of Sharp's Chosen Men, but stay tuned for more information on that. Join us tomorrow when we will be looking at moments that shaped the Cold War with Ian Sanders, who runs the Cold War Conversations podcast. And then on Tuesday, we will be looking at ancient Rome with Emma Southern, and we'll be talking Syrian matriarchs and putting into perspective ethnicity as far as the Romans are concerned a little bit. Don't forget that you can now become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. You can do this by going to www.historyhack.podbean.com, and it is much appreciated. While the army have been larking around and singing for you very nicely, I might add, His Majesty's Navy, on the other hand, have some serious words to impart.
I'm Horatio Hornblower, and I'm Archie Kennedy. The simplest gift you can give in these troubled times is to obey orders.
Indeed. The regulations are very clear in the matter. It is the duty of all of us to remain at anchor until the little people in the talking box signal you otherwise.
You don't want to end up getting flogged.
Good day to you.
Good day to you both.